Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Steve is asleep at the switch, but what's going on, man?
Well, good morning, folks. Today we have an interview with Tay Wiles, who's a writer for the High Country News. She's a reporter, really, and reports on a lot of which I guess you would call an extension and variations on the Sagebrush Rebellion that began so long ago, public lands controversy, and lots of other things. She has some interesting articles on the drop in the amount of land that has cattle on it and sheep in the West. It's been dropping for decades. And so she reports on a lot of things, but we want to talk to you, Tay, really about, you know, extremists in the anti-government movement. And I know that you wrote an article recently about a fellow who tried to bomb a BLM building. He's one of the people, I guess, who was at the Bundy ranch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So you're referring to William Kuebler, who was at the Bundy Ranch in 2014. And it's sort of the latest in what we're seeing as these heightened and near violent disputes around public land. So he allegedly tried to plant a bomb at a BLM facility in northern Arizona, and was arrested by the FBI, who had been embedded with him in a militia that he runs for many months. They'd been embedded with him, and they thwarted what his planned attack was, and he's been arrested. So, yeah, that's
really... Was he arrested in Arizona?
He was arrested in Utah, actually.
I see.
Yeah.
Now, where's Mount Trumbull?
Where is it?
Yeah.
I am not sure exactly. Northern Arizona. It's near, I think it's northwestern a little bit. It's near,
it's up by the Strip.
Oh, and that little no man's land up there. Yeah, quite. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's kind of his territory, right? I mean, that's
so,
where he was.
Well, it's actually, I mean, he's from Utah, but that area is near a grazing allotment of Lavoie Finicum, the man who was shot in the confrontation up in Oregon, who's originally from Utah. So he had a grazing allotment there. Finicum knew the area.
Yeah, I work with his dad. It's a long story.
Okay. I'd like to hear it sometime.
The elder Finicum. Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, that's great. All right. Go ahead.
So tell us a little bit about, I guess.
Let's back up and do High Country News first, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us about High Country News, because I've been a subscriber for a number of years, and it's the major magazine, I guess, reporting on land disputes, environments focused on the American West, right?
That's right. Yeah. We're a non-profit, twice monthly magazine founded in 1968. It's founded in Lander, Wyoming, and now is based in Paonia, Colorado, where I am calling you from now. We cover natural resources, a lot of public land disputes, and sort of where communities in the American West come into contact with natural resources. And we do have writers and editors who are dispersed in different states around the West.
Yeah, very effective. If you've been in the area for a while, you remember it as a large format publication maybe years ago. But now, of course, you can subscribe to it online, and we'll give you all that information later on in the show. But because it dealt with the West and the panoramic photography that is so, you know, such as it is, it's obvious everywhere. The large format was great and still has great pics. You take your own pictures, by the way, Tay. A lot of times reporters have to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have taken some pictures when I've been reporting on the ground, with the phone. Great cameras in the phone these days. But
yeah, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, just kind of doing it all at once, yeah.
So tell us about this budding conflict. Most people don't pay attention to it until you have something like the Bundy standoff, or when they seize a refuge in Oregon or something like that. But there's an ongoing conflict between militia groups, extremists, and just people who feel that they own public land, and it's there's some question about whether the federal government is reporting the number of attacks and incidents on their land protection personnel.
Yeah, there's a lot. So there's a lot in that question. I mean, as you and many of your listeners probably know, you know, the history of this goes back over 100 years when there was the heyday of ranching in the American West, and people were trying to figure out how to use land, and it was very unclear how much of the land would stay in federal hands, how much of it would be sold off and privatized or turned to state control. And that, you know, that conflict has not gone away. And in many ways, it's become more violent, more contentious than ever before. So there's a deep history to this, and a lot of it is rooted in the land transfer movement. So this idea that federal land should be transferred to state or local control, which also has a deep history back to the early 20th century. Through my reporting and what we've seen at High Country News is that there's a new twist on it that's just happened in the past few years. We're sort of calling it the sagebrush insurgency, in which there are two sets of people who are coming together, and that's the traditional sagebrush rebels, which are a subset of miners and ranchers who are more conservative and do believe in a land transfer idea, and then also people who maybe more based in cities and who are a little bit more ideologically driven on this, who don't know much at all about grazing rights or public lands, but who may be in a militia and may have issues with an African-American president or gun control. So they have come together with these more traditional rebels, the miners and ranchers, to lend a hand to their cause.
Well, and also perhaps personal gain from I'm glad you said subset of miners and ranchers, because, you know, obviously you can't live in Arizona most of your life like some of us and not have met a lot of upstanding ranchers and certainly honest and hardworking people working in the mines. But this is a new wrinkle. As you said, it's not a new wrinkle. It's a replay of an old wrinkle. But the demand for public lands, I saw a stat the other day that 94% of Americans live within 5 miles of some public land, and that the resistance to state takeover of public land is in the 60% area, that 60% of the people don't want states and private people to take over public land. And you said in one of your stories that the public lands debate is not necessarily a debate in some areas. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, are you referring to it just there being some areas where everyone is supporting a transfer, or
the certain states, Utah, Nevada has a
argument for a transfer, because these are public lands that belong to the whole American people, to everybody in the country.
Yeah.
And what's the basis of some county in Utah claiming the public lands that belong to the rest of us?
Well, and why in the middle of that answer, these are county governments going after this land?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the arguments today the federal government, the Forest Service, the BLM, they're these huge bureaucracies that have vast stretches of land to cover, to police, to manage, and they're chronically underfunded. So there are a lot of issues, as we all know, between local governments and the federal government in terms of how to manage the land. So, I mean, one interesting example I've found is in Montezuma County in Southwest Colorado. So I was speaking with a county commissioner there who was talking about this mountain biking mecca that they have there, Phil's World. And
say the name again.
Phil's World.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Phil's World. So he really wants to expand it, and other people there do too as well. Want to double the size of this place. It would be an economic boon for the county, bring more people in, and be good for recreation, the recreation economy. But he also supports a land transfer. He supports the American Land Council, and he thinks that the way to expand this. It's a bike bike trails on BLM land, and he thinks the way to expand it would be to get BLM out of the picture and just transfer all that land either to the county or to the state so that they could do it on their own, because right now the BLM is taking its time and looking at alternatives and figuring out how to do it.
In your story, it talked about cultural sites and all the things that we expect the BLM to consider when they when they do things with land, whatever alternatives there are to protect the resources.
So their argument is we can do this quicker and better, but
because they won't worry about cultural sites and
because they won't be as concerned with. From our point of view, we've had these big battles here, and there are our local state senators and representatives want to transfer, federal land to Arizona, and they want to sell off a lot of it for whatever highest use they can get. They'll keep some of it as public state land, but. If you're really interested in protecting things, that seems like a really terrible way to go. I guess my question is, one time I was doing I was a tour guide back a few years ago, and some guy asked me on a tour, he said, he was kind of like from Texas, and, he said, how did the federal government end up owning so much land in here in Arizona? And I said, well, the federal government, either bought, stole, or got all the land in the West. I mean, and so the question I've always wondered is how did so much of it get to be private? I mean, I'm not against it, but I think the process of is an interesting one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing that comes to mind when you talk about that, I mean, the BLM... the amount of acreage that the BLM managed has decreased over time, over the decades since it became an agency. And in Nevada, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, there was an unprecedented number of applications of private individuals and companies, businesses, wanting to buy BLM land, because there's just massive growth. There's just a huge period of growth. And so, a lot of this happened many, many decades ago that has put us in the situation where we are today. But, one of the interesting challenges with state land in particular and managing it is that it's so dispersed, and they're just sort of bits and pieces in a lot of places. And so the people I've spoken to say that there isn't much. Like, state land management is an oxymoron. I've heard a lot of people say that, but there isn't a lot of management because it's so difficult to do.
Yeah, and in Arizona, they couldn't keep the the rest stops open during the crash. They cut back on the program that I was a part of, which was a site steward program protecting archaeological sites. Almost all the work is.
If you couldn't
the argument here,
how are you going to keep the Grand Canyon open? Is the argument of most progressives? You guys can't manage your own backyard. How are you going to? And as you said in one of your stories, there is no plan. Nobody has come up with a plan yet. None of the sagebrush rebellers, none of the government people have come up with a plan of what they would do with the land if they got it.
It's true. I mean, that is true, and. One of the concerns is that the states would sell it off because they don't have the multiple use mandate, so they're not required to be managing for multiple uses, but to fund schools and other state institutions. So
that's key. That's a key phrase there. That multiple use mandate, the whole idea of public land for public purposes. You drive by and you see those Forest Service signs, land of many uses. That's not a joke. I mean, that's it used to be just in the way. Now it's an important statement.
Now, from your reporting, it looks like there are thousands of incidents of conflict between federal authorities and local people over land. How do you think this whole process, the sagebrush insurgency, this combination of militia groups, which we certainly have here in Arizona, and ranchers controlling the land? I mean, where I come from in Oklahoma, you either own land, and you raise your cattle on it, or you lease land from somebody who doesn't want to raise cattle, And that's that. There's no public land. There's no argument about it. You pay a going rate. Here, you know, the ranchers benefit from extraordinarily discounted land usage. And yet they're in rebellion against even that. It's like somebody demanding more when they're already getting a bargain.
Yeah. So the part of your question about ranching, I mean, I think that the grazing fees debate is a little bit of a red herring. A lot of environmentalists bring up that ranchers who use federal land allotments should be paying more. And yeah, it's true that the federal government loses money on their grazing programs. But I mean, I think really the root of the issue is how we conceive of federal land grazing as either a right or a privilege. We get so many people calling in and commenters and people arguing, is it, you know, it's a right? No, it's a privilege. So I mean, legally, of course, it's a privilege, no doubt, and that has stood the test of time through many, many lawsuits over the decades. Grazing on federal lands is considered a privilege. The problem is that, I mean, when ranching began in the American West so many years ago, when there began to be a grazing permitting system on federal lands, the early forest reserves, it began to be used as collateral for bank loans. So, and what happened was the Forest Service basically turned a blind eye to this because they knew how difficult it was to homestead and to create a life in the American West that they inadvertently sort of allowed people to use them as private property. And that idea of grazing permits on federal land as private property has remained. And so there are these dual conflicting ideas of what federal land grazing is, and I think that's one of the major challenges today.
And is that one of the major things? Well, I guess my question is that what's generating this, or is it a combination of a militia movement moving into these issues who hate the federal government, et cetera? I mean, what's the mix on the ground?
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, that what I just described has definitely been driving conflict. I mean, in southern Utah, I mean, with national monuments all over the West, this idea that grazing there is a right that definitely drives conflict when the national monument is created or something like that. But today, yeah, it's more militia groups, people who have political ideas about what America should be, coming in and teaming up with the sort of most anti-federal ranchers, which of course is a subset of ranchers.
Well, you know, it's certainly also, at least on our we talk about, we got to name names here, for and against. You know, we got our Paul Gosar, our representative from this district, and certainly he's a Tea Party favorite. And but you did a story just not too long ago on Raul Grijalva, one of our Arizona representatives that is, as far as I'm concerned, a hero in the movement and as another progressive things. And tell us about that meeting. That was a strange meeting. They use the word war.
Yeah, so this was a meeting a few weeks ago that members of the House Natural Resources and Homeland Security committees called together. Grijalva was there. Uh-huh. And it was to address what he calls extremism on public lands. Uh-huh. He has definitely taken this up as one of his causes. I mean, the person who called it a war is simmering was actually, I think, someone from the Southern Poverty Law Center who's a witness who spoke there. And then also there was a woman who was a former head of Colorado and Nevada BLM who wrote a letter that over a dozen former federal employees and many sort of heads of the BLM, heads of the Forest Service, signed on to, that sort of outlined all of these different threats to public safety, threats to public land, that we're seeing arise in the West. So I thought that was really interesting because it was one of the first times that so many sort of high profile federal employees came together to speak out about it.
Yeah, it sounded like, and the story sounded like there was this swell of of concern, you know, of people threatening folks, of people, the groups wanting the land, not necessarily be having the national discussion we might want to have before we start turning over federal land to anyone. And but did I read that Homeland Security was there?
Yeah, that is. I mean, I think it was just a representative. It wasn't the whole committee. Yeah.
Yeah, it was the Democratic. I guess he's the Democratic senior member of the Homeland Security Committee.
Well, the idea is that this is a threat to our security. That when you have people declaring war over land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's been for, I think, maybe 2 years now, it's been sort of one of the top threats that the FBI has listed. It sort of bumped Islamic extremism as something that law enforcement perceives as a threat, was sort of domestic extremism and they're calling it domestic terrorism.
Do you think they're keeping an eye on this situation? Because sometimes we feel here in the West that back East, they don't understand the problem. I see the environmental groups are campaigning against plastic bottles in the Grand Canyon. I think that's wonderful, but we're having trouble hanging on to the Grand Canyon as a national park out here.
Well, it's so underfunded. Listen, we're talking to Tay Wiles, reporter and editor for the High Country News. A publication which you've seen all over the place, hopefully, if you've traveled in northern Arizona and the West, and is available online.
Let me just ask again: do you think that they're aware of how serious the problem is out here in Washington? Do you think they're taking action to protect federal employees? Are they tracking these militia movements? We did an interview with a fellow from Homeland Security who tracked them, who was, I guess they didn't like a report he did. This is years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, on my skin name escapes me, and they sort of pushed him out of Homeland Security. But he was tracking the groups, much like, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center does. And so are they aware of the seriousness of this? Are they suppose the president declares Bears Ears a national monument? Are they prepared for a reaction? I mean, it sounds like some people, politicians in Utah, are calling for violence. They're saying that violence will happen, but you know it can be kind of a way of calling for violence?
That's a really, really great question. And it's something that we'd like to look more into. I mean, when Bundy Ranch happened in 2014, there was a lot of criticism, of course, about how the BLM handled it and then how the DOJ handled it and Interior. And since then, of course, with William Keebler and with Malheur, we've seen the federal government take more of a stand against these threats. So, I mean, with Keebler, they were monitoring him for months. So you have to think, okay, if they picked up on this guy who is at Bundy Ranch, are they following others? So, you know, it's been frustrating as a reporter with the lack of information that we can get from the BLM. You know, they're kind of hunkering down, and we don't get a lot of information about how they're responding to this. But I mean, one of the big questions I have is the relationship between the BLM and the Department of Justice is how do these incidents get passed between agencies? And I mean, where is the breakdown here in response to these types of incidents in which agency? But I'm not sure how to answer your question because we're going to have to see what happens in South Utah in the coming
weeks.
Well,
that's true. The missions of both agencies. I mean, who handles armed conflict? Certainly, I don't believe the BLM has that in their charter, and the Department of Justice probably seems more suitable to handle that. But if that's not the only consideration, so yeah, there is a blur of who's responsible for what when it comes to this sort of insurgency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know that the BLM has been sort of rethinking how they organize law enforcement, their regional law enforcement and their special agents in charge, and sort of trying to rethink that so that they have stronger relationships with local sheriffs and things like that so that they can respond well.
All right. Well, listen, I don't want to leave public lands. I think this is a story that's still developing, but I do also want to direct our listeners to Tay Wiles' writing in the High Country News. It certainly can help you sort out a lot of it. We didn't talk about yet much about the Koch-backed American Land Council. And, of course, as you say in your story, they deny taking Koch funding, yet they list the Kochs as funders, which seems to be a contradiction. So there's so much to talk about here. And we have about 20 minutes left, and we certainly want to cover. But part of this
Explain this web of organizations like the American Lands Council that Mike's asking about, because I don't think most people have heard of it, and I don't think most people know what it does.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you asked about the American Lands Council.
Yes, that's
the question. So, the American Lands Council started sort of end of 2012 or early 2013 by couple county commissioners in Utah and one in Nevada as a way to try to transfer federal land to state control. And they're sort of the building blocks of the organization are counties, county commissioners who can choose to become a member. Memberships range from $50 for individuals up to $25,000 is one of the sort of municipal membership levels. So that's a lot of how they're funded, but then they also get other large donors. And how it actually works, I think is a little bit of a mystery. They're pretty secretive about how they operate, but I know that they do have sort of local trainings. They go around the West and have local trainings and educate people on this idea of transferring lands to states.
Well, this idea of money and counsel, like legal, you know, advice seems to be one of the forces, and probably, I don't know, and a big force behind this movement becoming more effective. It's one thing to have people jumping up and down in Oregon and saying the federal government is mean, and it's another to have the American Land Council actually taking over beautiful lands in the West, or making sure there's unrestricted grazing.
So why should we let county commissioners control our public lands? I mean, I don't mind sharing or whatever else, but there's not only the American Lands Council, but when I research for the National Monument here, there's a whole bunch of non-profits, research think tanks and stuff all promoting these ideas. It's not just them. They're a little like Alex, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that's provided most of the state government laws for the last 20 years. Tay, we want to make you aware that the Sedona, and our listeners, that remind them that there is a movement in the Sedona area to make some of the surrounding forest a national monument. Too, because we're worried about land trades. We're worried about losing the very beauty that draws people here. You mentioned all the national monuments in southern Utah. You and I have been to some of the most beautiful places in the world. We've got Colorado, Utah, Arizona, Nevada, depending on your definition of beauty. But certainly the and it seems like all of this is being threatened at once. It's like so much, and this is a partisan show, so we don't pretend to be nonpartisan here. You have to, we don't. And congratulations on that. But these people are nuts. I mean, this is an attack on those lands that we all enjoy. We've certainly had a system of of putting lands in public hands that we could all use, some of the most beautiful places, some of the most historic, some of the cultural sites, all of these things that are contained within so much of what the country's all about, let alone the West. I'm sorry, I'm getting on my own soapbox here. But I don't want to, there's so much to talk about public lands. Part of the show today is to get our readers to know the person we're interviewing. And I'm looking at a story that you did on Snowflake and some, what happened there? That you had a group of people, the chemical, I have to admit, you can't swing a dead cat, which is probably a lousy analogy, and not find a lot of chemically sensitive people in Sedona.
This has nothing to do with public lands.
Nothing to do with public lands. We're moving on to your writing.
Do you want me to give you a brief synopsis of it? Actually, The Guardian
We're lightening up here, I guess, is what I'm saying. We're trying to cover all the bases.
So this is a story I wrote about a town in eastern Arizona, Snowflake. And it's a group of people who have experienced what they call severe chemical sensitivities, both to chemicals but also electromagnetic radiation. And so they have come to this area because there's clean air, clean water. There weren't any cell phone towers when they first moved in. I don't know if it was 10 or 15 years ago or something like that. And they are able to live an existence that where they don't get sick. It is an American West story because it is about how we use our land and how there are fewer and fewer spaces that aren't being developed in some way or affected, trammeled, in some way. And so these people are sort of trying to retreat from that, but it's increasingly difficult.
I'm curious, what put you onto the story?
A friend of mine had heard of it somewhere. I think she had come across, they have a website that just sort of explains who they are for people who are curious about moving there.
The public land story is huge. It's everywhere now. Like you said, 2012 doesn't seem that long ago, even if you're as young as you are. And so to have this insurgency forming and become such a force in a relatively short time.
I guess my question, Tay, is how do you think this is, or do you, because you're on the ground reporting incidents and stories in detail about what happens here and what happens there. How do you think this is all going to play out, or do you have an idea how it'll play out, this conflict?
I don't have a great idea, but it's hard not to be a little pessimistic sometimes. I think that the biggest challenge going forward is civil discourse. I mean, I think that there are a lot of factors right now playing against that, going against us having good civil discourse. I think that the internet is actually a big part of this story. It's an amazing equalizer, and I have a lot of great things to say about using it as a tool for democracy, but I think that it's also a place where people can find their own echo chamber and be their ideas can be reinforced.
No matter how erroneous they might be.
In dangerous ways. I think extremism globally also, I think we've seen a shift in the past couple months in terms of extremism worldwide, and I think that sort of raises everyone's blood pressure a little bit and makes everything seem like an existential threat, even if it is, about public lands in Arizona. Donald Trump isn't doing a lot to help.
That's true. Exactly. We talked about the counties at the county level, as particularly in the West, that pay membership dues to the American Land Council, and who's expressed intent is to transfer public lands into more local control. But they keep their list secret. Is there any way, at least, have you had any success or your colleagues had any success in publicizing this list? This seems like this should be a kind of a government thing that they shouldn't be allowed to hide that.
I'm working on it. I mean, it would be good to know just how, what role, you know, rural counties we are playing in this major movement. And we do have a map online at hcn.org that shows, that has all the data that we have so far about which counties are members or have been in recent years. And as you can see on it, the Nevada and Utah are the...
Our Coconino County, which half of Sedona is, has been very strongly opposed to transferring public lands to the state.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And I noticed it on your map.
Uh-huh.
I want to ask you a question. I was up in Escalante, and we were talking to a coal truck driver, and he was hating Obama, just hating Obama was destroying the coal industry. And I know you've written about the drop in the number of jobs in producing coal. I mean, this is a fundamental conflict. I mean, people don't want to use coal. It's not as there's a lot of economic forces. There's a lot of regulatory forces. But this gentleman was really angry and furious, and I could never promise him he could find another job that pays as well as driving a coal truck to the railroad or whatever he was doing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, I that's definitely part of this conversation. I think that we're seeing this drop in the coal industry, and Obama is at the center of that for a lot of people who perceive him and his regulations as being the main reason for that. And yeah, I mean, I do think that fuels the public land disputes as well, and is part of sort of the ideology that a lot of these militia groups on the more extreme end have. I mean, the same is true for grazing. It's this idea that environmental regulation is the only factor in a change in the industry, when it is a primary factor, but not the only factor.
When I was in Escalante in the backcountry, there are areas there the streams and the springs are absolutely chewed up by cattle grazing. I mean, they're several hundred long yards of mud pies. There's very polluted water and stuff. So it's not like there's not grazing on a national monument. It seems to me that, you know, and there's a real lack of large four-footed critters that, as far as I could see in the background, including looking for tracks, it seems like they're able to graze their cattle, you know, despite all of this. And there's some question if there aren't raising too many cattle on the, you know, I guess this delicate, very dry land.
Well, that's a huge argument there, Stephen. But yeah, that's.
I guess my question, Mike, and Tay, is, given the fact that, you know, that you can do grazing on almost all or a huge percentage of federal land, BLM and Forest Service and stuff, why is there this fury over regulation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so where were you talking about when you saw the Trammell watershed?
We were down in... I can't remember exact. We were down in the major watershed, walking along
southern Utah, at least.
In southern Utah, in Escalante, in the main sort of section of it. You know, when you drive to the hole in the wall,
okay.
It was a side trail down there, and we followed the dry stream bed for a very long way, and we came to the spring that was completely chewed up. You know, I like cattle personally. You know, I was raised next to a cattle ranch, but it did seem to be that there's still a lot of damage being done.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about that. But the question about why there's so much anger over regulation. I mean, so I did a project where I pulled a bunch of data from old Forest Service and BLM reports to look at the change and the fluctuations in AUMs that were permitted and AUMs, number of livestock on the rangeland on federal rangeland that were permitted and that were used. And it's a huge decrease, especially on BLM. I mean, since the 1940s when they started keeping track. And I think that that is, I mean, it's a generational understanding of a relationship with the federal government. That it's multi-generational, you know, it's passed down. This is not just the story of the past couple of years. So I think that sure, there's still a lot of grazing in place in delicate landscapes, but if you look at the big picture, it's gone down a lot.
That's good, and I think you're absolutely correct. But there's still that simmering resentment. I do want to go back to the coal thing that. In other governments, in other places, the anxiety over this poor gentleman, this truck driver, his retraining would have been obvious, would have been guaranteed, would have been in the future. I mean, he would be training for another job. He would know that that was coming. In our pull you up. Republican-controlled pull-yourself-up-by-your-own-bootstraps economy, he's going to suffer that anxiety. There may be no retraining. He will. His lifestyle will decline as he becomes less involved in coal.
I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, if there were a more coherent climate policy and energy policy at the highest level, at the federal level, I think that we there would just be a better plan for people who are sort of caught in a changing industry, in a changing market, global market. So I, you know, leadership on climate and energy are sorely needed.
I think we're all sympathetic to the situation of the changes in culture, whether it's in ranching or it's in decline of people are not eating as much beef as they used to, and in coal. So I think we're really sympathetic to the people. I didn't hate this guy, even though he's furiously angry and pretty much racist toward President Obama. But I kind of understand that there is a real problem here. Mike, we've got a couple of minutes left.
Yeah, Tay, don't go away, but we do have some announcements to make. Thursday, July 21st, 8 a.m., we have a speaker over at El Sedona. This is Tomas Robles is going to talk about a living wage. It's not $8.05 an hour. That's the title of his speech over at El Sedona Bar and Grill. We have breakfast, and please come and listen to Thursday, July 21st, 8 o'clock in the morning. Actually, gets going about 8:30. Learn how a rising minimum wage boosts the economy and keeps families together and doesn't cost jobs. And I don't care what they say, but please come listen to Tomas. We have Democrats of the Red Rocks meetups in their new campaign office at 2855 West 89A. The phone number is 239-1880. And Sunday nights, you can go over and chat. Please be unarmed, and we can talk about some of the issues of the day.
Certainly. Check out High Country News. It's a great magazine. It's a great online presence. It has really wonderful writers like Tay Wiles. And we very much appreciate you being on the show and the work that that your magazine does.
We're excited about the magazine, Tay, because you cover the issues that we like.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Let's do this again. Someday.
That sounds great. The issue won't go away.
And exactly. And next time, obviously you travel throughout the West. You can stop in our area. We'd be happy to chat with you. We'll fill you in on the Sedona movement, on the National Monument, and all that stuff. Don't forget, this podcast will be on VVID.org. You'll get this podcast and all our podcasts. Goodbye. Good luck.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.